Hello, I'm Florian Loder, and recently I had the opportunity to hear the story of two Russells, Wilfred Russell Grimwade and Russell Howard. Both men share some parallels in their life, even though they were born about a century apart. Both were educated at the University of Melbourne and had careers in chemistry and biochemistry. Both have been successful entrepreneurs, but in particular, they both share a wonder and curiosity of life. Not too long ago, on the 17th of November 2016, I had the opportunity to speak with Russell Howard, who had just been honoured with the inaugural Grimwade Medal for Biochemistry, an award that arose through the Magunya bequest of Russell and Mab Grimwade, which they left in their will to further the discipline of biochemistry. Russell Howard is an alumnus of the University of Melbourne, having graduated with a PhD in biochemistry. He's had a successful career in studying malaria and then going on to become an entrepreneur, where he has led a number of companies in the biotech sector. After 30 years in the US, he has recently returned to Australia, where he continues to support the translation of research to industry in a spin-off company called Genome One. So I started by asking Russell the question about how he would describe himself.
I'm someone who is passionate about life and living things. From an early age, I've always wondered at why is it so to see, you know, an ant talking to another ant on a piece of concrete, or a bird flying and knowing where it's going, and myself as a human growing and changing. So I've always been fascinated by living things and how they work from an earliest age. But at 13, I said, do I want to be a professor that completely understands a single living cell? And I knew at age 13 about bacteria or beautiful single-celled algae or plants and human cells. Do I want to study a single cell and know it by the end of my life completely? That was one mission in my head. Or the other was to be a jewelry designer. And as it turns out, I decided to study eventually the life sciences. So here I am. I think I just have a childlike simplicity when it comes to wonderful things. I enjoy surprises and I enjoy the joy of seeing nature. I mean, if someone has got to the stage in their life where they aren't thrilled by seeing a bird fly across the sky, then there's something wrong with them. But then I ask the next question, where are they flying? How does migration of birds work? How does oxygenation of the bird lung work, etc., etc.? I just ask the next sort of question. So it's also amazing that it works. It's amazing to me to think that a snail is born. It doesn't read a book. It doesn't go to school, but it knows to be snail. And this is just, to me, an amazing question. So maybe I'm a Buddhist, but there's as much beauty in an ant or a snail or a beautiful tree as there is in human art.
And you spent your PhD studying a blue-green algae that was pretending to be fungi?
I was studying, actually it's not a blue-green alga, it's a complex alga because it is multi-chloroplastic and multi-nucleate. But it's a single cell with no cell walls, and it actually is macroscopic. It'll cover an entire rock. So it could be 6 feet by 4 feet, a single cell. And then the really curious thing about it as a single cell, once you understand biology and how cells go to make tissues, how can a single cell with chloroplasts and nuclei streaming all through its cytoplasm across the whole plant actually have beautiful green fronds that go upwards towards the light and a rhizome like a strawberry rhizome that spreads it over the rock, and then tiny little rootlets with a completely different shape that go down and attach tightly to the rock? How can you have differentiation of the cell wall when everything is bathed in the same cytoplasm? So there's just questions looking at that thing that beg other questions. And so my PhD was to follow a hypothesis put forward by my PhD mentor, Bruce Grant, of maybe this unusual unicellular macroscopic structure is just like a fungus, because there are many fungi that are known that also are multinucleate and macroscopic but have essentially a single cell. And so he thought maybe this is a fungus that was invaded late on in evolution by a blue-green alga to create this green plant. And so essentially that's what my PhD proved, to the level of showing that the chloroplasts of this organism behave normally. So we proved the hypothesis that this looks like some sort of synergy between a fungus and a blue-green alga.
And then you moved on to malaria and mm-hmm. you proved yourself a good communicator because you found a way of relating your PhD topic to malaria. Can you tell us how you did that and the importance of communication in your life?
Yes, I've actually had 9 conversations I can plot that have been the changes in my career, and each one has been between 5 and 15 minutes. And in not one of them was it really an interview to an advertised position. In each case, it was me being with someone and discussing something with them. And in the case of my move from marine biochemistry into malaria, it was a 5-minute conversation with Professor Gustav Nossel in his office at the Walter and Eliza, where under the urging, I will admit, of my wife at the time, who was at the WEHI and knew of the work that they were doing, said, "My God, you should try and get a job in this new parasitology group that Graham Mitchell is setting up." And so I meditated on how on earth could I join the illustrious crew at WEHI when I'm not an immunologist or a parasitologist. I was a marine biochemist. So I admit that on the fly, as I just walked into Gus's office, the thoughts occurred to me. I was not able to think of what on earth to say ahead of time, but as I walked into his office, it came together. And I sat down and said, introduced myself, and said, because of my knowledge at how the chloroplast of a plant communicates metabolically with the cytoplasm of the plant in order to have a flux between storage and energy use, I should be an expert at how the intracellular malaria parasite communicates with the host red cell cytoplasm. So I understand the complex interaction of such life systems, and I think it'd be great if I could join the lab and work on malaria. And he immediately leaned across the table and said, "Wonderful, wonderful, come and join us, work with Graham Mitchell." That was it. And thus began a 13-year career in which I worked to solve a single biological problem.
And it wasn't a strategy, it was following your passion.
The passion soon started when I learnt about malaria in the first few weeks, and then learnt about the most virulent of the 4 human malarias, and then decided to focus on why is this particular of the 4 malarias the most virulent, and it seemed to me to be related to the propensity of the asexual stage to evade pre-existing immunity, coupled with the extraordinary fact that as the intracellular parasite matured from one organism to 36 daughter cells, approximately, it hid away from the natural clearance mechanism of the body of the spleen. So rather than the infected cells having to be compressed in the spleen and therefore the parasite killed and destroyed by local macrophages, the cell chooses to multiply the intracellular parasites sequestered away in deep tissues. And there it gets big and fat and non-deformable and then erupts for the merozoites to come out and invade new cells. So this 2 properties, antigenic variation that appeared to be expressed at the red cell surface and a virulence property of attachment to microvascular endothelium, to me had to be there on the surface of the cell as molecular entities, and my hypothesis was, wouldn't it be interesting if they were indeed expressed on the same molecule? So that was an hypothesis. There was no evidence for a molecule at all, simply the biological phenomena of antigenic variation. Indeed, not in falciparum malaria, but in some other malarias. And I said, I think there's antigenic variation in falciparum. Let's go about and prove it. And I'm sure there's a new cell attachment factor on the surface of falciparum-infected cells. Let's try and figure that out. And so it took me 13 years to do it.
Which is an incredible commitment to a question. But then you changed tack and went into the business world and also became an entrepreneur. In your early years, as a student, you described yourself as not really being worrying about money. You had $20 a week after rent to live on. So money didn't play an awful big role back then. And later on, you went on to make an awful lot for other organisations and for yourself. What attitude have you got towards money? And
I don't work for money. I work for me and for doing something that I believe in. During my undergraduate years and PhD, I never had a moment's thought about what will be my career, will I ever be able to afford a house or a boat or a car or have a family. It did not occur to me once. I had food, not a lot. I lived in crummy accommodation, but I was working on most wonderful problems. And eventually, I will add that whenever I had a job interview, in not a single job interview I've ever had, at the interview did I discuss money. I simply said, I did define always what my position would be, the title. And with title comes a certain range of money. So I defined the title because that would give me power and respect and the ability to do what I want with a certain title. But I never discussed the salary and never discussed the important element of options or equity. I knew that I would get some, and we'd argue about that later, because the main purpose of the initial interview is to see if we're sympathetic with each other and we get on well and can trust each other. And why I would want to jump into someone's organization, we have to believe in each other. And later we can argue, or even other people can argue with me about, am I fairly paid? That's all I need. And so my attitude is to money is a tool, it's not an aim. And I'm curious about people who spend their whole lives just chasing money, because in the end they end up with a lot of money and not a lot else. But that's just a personal opinion. They may be perfectly happy, but I can't see being happy just with a lot of money.
But even people who seek it as a tool worry about it a lot. Probably a lot of the scientists in this building worry a great deal about how their futures will continue. Have times changed, or have you just fared well with your approach?
I do now worry about money. I have multiple dependents on two continents, and I have an expensive house and an expensive lifestyle. I burn cash like crazy. So I worry about money now, but not in the way that a struggling student would be worrying about their career. I don't know if times have changed at all. I think it's just in you, whether you, as a younger person, care about money and a defined career path. It wasn't just the money. I did not care about money. I did not care about a planned career path, about I want to be an X, right? I'd lost the early idea of a child, of I want to be a professor. It was I'm in love with my alga, or I'm in love with my malaria problem. And the real thought was, how will I capitalize on what I'm doing at WEHI in order to get to the best next place in the world where I can keep this wrestling match on with the parasite to solve the problem? And then after leaving the NIH, how could I maintain my work on malaria while working in fields where people were dragging me outside malaria because they wanted me to contribute management skills to their organizations? So I was literally always demanding that I did my malaria work on external funds, grant funds, while agreeing to help other people in a management role for their company. So I actually was bridging two worlds. It was very interesting.
Which leads to the next question about success. You've been very successful pursuing your interest in malaria, lots of papers, over 145 papers, and you solved your problem. And you've been successful as a business person, entrepreneur. And in your talk, you mentioned that in an organization, success, or in the business world, can be defined in very different ways, and it depends very much on the creators and how they define the success of their business. What does success mean to you personally, or what has it meant, and how has it changed?
Well, it certainly doesn't mean 145 papers. Of my 145 papers, I'd say maybe 5 to 10 are really, really good and significant and should be read by a young person who was entering that particular field. All of the rest of them were produced by the excessive enthusiasm of youth of, oh my God, I've discovered something, let me publish it. And I was certainly, while not chasing money, I was definitely aggressive, committed, and persistent with respect to publishing, because I knew that publications were the mark of achievement. And whether I was at a private company and running my malaria work on the side, I had to publish in order to garner funds. Whether I was at the NIH running a lab of 50 people, I had to publish in order to maintain my status. So I chased the ephemeral, as it were, of papers for paper's sake. So papers are not the success of life. Some of my papers, I think, are really good, and they're the ones that I regard as successful. I had one eureka moment in my scientific life of recognizing in an instant, I've solved the problem. After that, there was a lot of hard work to do to prove it to other people, but I knew I had it, and I was the one person who had it in my hands. That was a wonderful moment. So that was an amazing success that I'll always carry in my head. And then success otherwise is, I think, helping other people, actually, and enjoying the process and making money at the same time. It's a pretty good deal if you can. And it's all at risk. When I say making money, I'm not making money as some sort of gift that comes from the sky. It's making money through working damn hard at risk in order to create something bigger and better than what is there now. And so you only get money if you're successful at growing a business's value. And only if there's an exit and the business is finally bought by someone or goes public and you can get liquidity. So success to me is growing something, right? And growing a business and interacting through people. And I must say the really fun part of my role as, let's say, an executive chairman of a company is getting around the table and debating where we are now, what our strengths and weaknesses are, and what do we do next with some new opportunity that has landed on the desk. Or, my God, there are no opportunities on the desk. What do we do? It's the verbal wrestling with ideas and conversations and the whiteboard in front of me that, to me, is the most exciting thing. And I really enjoy that. So I feel successful at the moment because I have wonderful relationships in the companies I have, and I feel responsible, appreciated, and importantly, catalytic. I'm able to change the company, and I'm able to contribute. I'm able to debate ideas, receive criticism, give criticism. It's a very dynamic and exciting environment. So that's success.
The other side of success is failure. Mm-hmm. And the way you described failure is a badge of experience in your mm-hmm. talk, but it mustn't have always felt like that. But it's a part, very much a part of the scientific process, and it's probably very much a part of business life as well. How have you learnt to deal with failure, and what's your attitude to it?
Failure is a challenge. At the moment, I'm chairman of a struggling clean tech company in California. I devoted 3 years of my life to a concept that I still believe in, but not a lot of other people believe in it. And so I worked for 3 years putting my own money into the company and didn't work on a single other thing. Together with another man, we developed a series of technologies that, through microbes, allow us to take the exit flue gas from an industrial plant, like a cement plant or a diesel-fired factory, take that exit gas that's full of toxics and CO2, bubble it through water containing proprietary microbes that we developed, and those microbes take out the CO2 from the gas, and provided we pump in pure molecular hydrogen gas as the only input source, the only cost into this process, these microbes, called chemoautotrophs, will take CO2 and hydrogen and make their body. And they'll make a really interesting drop-in fuel, N-butanol, very valuable fuel, and they can also be engineered to make bioplastic. So we've proven this process at small scale, in situ, at a cement plant, and also at an oil refinery in Canada. So the technology works at small scale. And at the moment, it's simply a little curiosity, because until we can do it at pilot scale of, let's say, somewhere between 50 and 500 litres, and get it to work reproducibly, then you're going to make an investment of several tens of millions to get it to work at maybe 1,000 litres and then 10,000 litres. And this would be a multi-step process. And so despite the fact that we're converting CO2 that ends up in the atmosphere and contributes to global warming from an industry like the cement industry, which is the most anthropogenic form of CO2 production from any human product, cement is number one. 5 to 6% of anthropogenic CO2 is from cement manufacture worldwide. And so it's just staring us in the face that we should reduce the obligatory step of calcium carbonate to calcium oxide and the release of CO2. You can't get around it. That's the process. And so that CO2 is always going to come off when you make cement, and humans are going to make cement for a few more centuries. Maybe carbon fiber will replace it, who knows. But anyway, cement is a terrible process, and we have a technology that solves it. But until we can get someone to put in high-risk capital for us to test whether our process works at larger scale, it's simply a story. And so that, to me, is not success at the moment. It's just limping along with continuous infusions of my money with the eternal hope that maybe one day someone else will perceive its value. So that takes persistence and, one could even argue, stupidity, because I could have cut my relationship with the company and said, go down the toilet, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, but I haven't. And so persistence can be a blessing if we do turn the corner, or stupid persistence.
This is obviously a technology with huge potential that you believe in, and it's not just about making money. This can make a huge difference.
Yeah, exactly. That's why we're doing it.
Yeah, so failure is a tragedy.
The technology has no value unless it gets used, and unless it's used and is actually cost-effective and does what we believe it should do. Otherwise, it should not exist. And so we are simply hoping for the chance to prove whether it is of value or not. That's what we want. You know, it'll take maybe $2 to $5 million, and if it works, it'll just go on and become a really valuable technology. But if it doesn't deserve to work, it should be killed. So the disappointing thing is that it's not getting that test. That's all you can ask of a technology. Is it appropriately tested at doing what you think it should do?
Obviously, this involves huge risk and commitment by people that to your story and who believe that this is possible. You started out as a scientist, and you've gone into this very high-risk area. It's obviously not for everybody, even though there's lots of ideas generated in science on a daily basis. What does it take for a scientist to enter this world of high risk?
I think it's idealism, because when you think of it, all scientists, I think, are idealists, but they express it in different ways. And some of us express our idealism with the thought that science, in other words, hypothesis-driven inquiry and proof of principle and, you know, negation and throwing things out if they don't work, that that should be at the base of making rational decisions about how to improve the world. And whether you're working on a novel drug or on a new system to clean air or on, you know, better tires to put on cars, whatever it is, if it's something that can improve the world, it's going to be driven by logic and spending, always limiting financial and people and time resources to do something. So if you're always going to be limited, as you are, by time, people, and opportunity cost and money, you may as well do something that you think will add good to the world. Mm-hmm. And so I think all scientists are inherently idealist, and some of us just take it to another level of saying, let's now try and solve that problem and create something valuable. It's different to the different sort of value of someone who works on, let's say, an app or invents a new cartoon character, right? That's great because it makes people happy, right? But in the end, it's replaceable by another cartoon character or another app. It doesn't really change the world. And by the world, I don't just mean people living in the United States, Canada, UK, etc. I mean the world. So if you want to change the world, you need to work on bigger problems, major diseases or major environmental issues, major mental health issues, major societal issues.
You continue to help people or scientists to make money. You're at the Garvan, head of strategy for commercialization, if I'm correct. Or could you?
I'm head of strategy for a spin-off from the Garvan.
Ah.
So the Garvan Institute is a not-for-profit institution.
Yes.
Dedicated to translational medicine. Mm-hmm. There was a group within the Garvan dedicated to understanding the human genome, how to sequence it at very high quality, how to do bioinformatics, and it was funded entirely by competitive grants and philanthropy. From that group, the moment we achieved NATA accreditation, that's regulatory accreditation, for the process all the way from a genetic consultation and blood draw through next-generation sequencing, bioinformatics, and then genetics counselling, that whole integrated process is now NATA accredited to provide clinical reports to people with a suspected genetic condition. When we had NATA accreditation for the fully integrated process, we then spun out an entity called Genome One, Genome.1. It also happens to be its internet name is Genome.1. And so I'm now working with other people there on the strategy for the company. And so that's my job, to try and figure out how we take this technology that is technically the best technology in its precision, technically the whole genome and not only part of the genome, but expensive. At this time, it's a Ferrari, and it does the best you can imagine, but it's expensive for an individual patient. So our challenge is to figure out how we take this technology and create a bona fide, sustainable, profitable business that through delivering a great product that customers want, expands right across Australia and potentially into the rest of the world.
That was Russell Howard speaking with me at the Bio21 Molecular Science and Biotechnology Institute of the University of Melbourne. I'm Florianne Loder. Thanks for listening.